the way he was taking his life in his hands, literally, for the sake of getting her back in control of herself and her gift. He was kind. He was gentle. He was considerate, and with the way her mind had been playing tricks on her lately, it was more than a possibility that she'd unconsciously used her gift to influence the way he thought about her, even to the point of getting him into bed with her. Lady knew she was no beauty, and if she had influenced him in that, she could have caused an even deeper attraction. She clenched her hands on her mug so hard they ached. That was one thing she had not wanted. At least not originally. But now? She liked Chris well enough. Well enough, but not that well. She was attracted to Dirk. There was no question about that. And strongly. More strongly than she'd ever felt about anyone. It was almost, she decided a bit reluctantly, as if Dirk was some hitherto unrecognized, hitherto unmissed other half of herself, and that she'd never again feel whole after having met him unless what? Heralds seldom made any kind of long-term commitment, contenting themselves with the close friendship of the circle, casual, strictly physical liaisons, and the bonds of their companions. And truly few heralds she knew were at all dissatisfied with that kind of life. Realistically speaking, the job was far too dangerous to make a life bond possible or desirable. Look what had happened to Karen when Ilsa died. If Cheryl hadn't had exactly what she needed and been right on the spot, she might very well have death-willed herself in bereavement. And she'd only seen Dirk a handful of times. But for heralds, sometimes only once was enough. Her mind drifted back years. It was late one night that they'd all been gathered in Karen's room over hot mulled wine and sometimes ribald conversation. Somehow the subject turned from bawdy jokes to the truth behind some of the legends and tales told by outsiders about heralds. They were laughing at some of the more absurd exaggerations.
"Take that love at one glance nonsense," Talia had giggled. "Someone ought to really take the bards to task over that one. How could anyone know from the first meeting that someone they've just met will be a life partner?"
"Oddly enough, that's not an exaggeration," Cheryl had replied soberly. "When it happens with heralds, that's generally exactly the way it happens. It's almost as if there was something even deeper than instinct that recognizes the other soul." She shrugged. "Metaphysical, sentimental, but still true."
"Do you mean to tell me that both of you had that happen?" Talia had been incredulous.
"As a matter of fact, the very first time I set eyes on Karen," Cheryl replied, "notwithstanding the fact that I was just under 14 at the time."
Karen nodded. "Ilsa and I knew when we met midway through our third year. Until then, we'd never done more than wave at each other across the room since we had had very different schedules. We did wait, though, until we were both sure that it was something solid and not ephemeral, and until we'd completed our internships before committing to each other.
And I didn't want to intrude on what was obviously a life bond."
"You would have been welcome. To tell you the truth, we'd wondered a little."
"But I didn't know that at the time, did I?" Cheryl had laughed. "Truly, though, Talia, anyone I've ever talked to that has seen a life bond has said the same thing. That was the way it was for Selene's parents, for instance. It either happens the first time you meet, or never."
"And if it's not a life bond, there's nothing you can do to make it one, to make it more than a temporary relationship, no matter how much you want it to be something more," Karen had continued. "My twin found that out."
Talia must have looked intensely curious, although she hadn't actually asked anything because Karen continued after a moment.
"Remember I've told you once or twice that I've got a niece and nephew almost your age? Well, they're Terrans. Not only were we not chosen at the same time, but it took 7 years for his companion to come for him. By then I was a field herald and he was married and working the sponge boat. Then it happened. He was chosen. And the wife he had thought he was contented with turned out to mean less to him than he'd ever dreamed. He wanted to love her, he really did. And he tried to make himself love her. It didn't work. He went through an incredible amount of soul-searching and guilt before concluding that the emotion wasn't there and wasn't going to be, and that his real life was with the circle and his companion. And to tell the truth, his wife, now ex-wife, didn't really seem to care. His children were adopted into our family, and she turned around and married into another with no sign of regret that I could see.
So you see, she had concluded, if you're a herald, you either have a life bond and recognize it at once, or you live your life without one.
Talia sighed. If she were going to be honest with herself, she had to admit that this seemed to be exactly what had happened to her with regard to Dirk. Seemed to be, that was the key. How did she know that this wasn't some fantasy she was building in her own mind? It didn't feel much like a fantasy, though. It was more like a toothache. Or perhaps the way Jadis had felt about his missing leg. He'd said it had often seemed as if it were still there, and aching. Well, there was something in Talia that ached, too. Fine. What about Chris? What she felt for Chris just wasn't that deep. Yes, she needed him. His support, his expertise, his encouragement, but need was just not the same as love. Or rather, the emotion she felt for him was a different kind of love, a comradeship, actually closer to what she felt for Roland or Skiff or even Karen than anything else. But if Chris had become infatuated with her, gods, it almost didn't bear thinking about. Granted, he certainly wasn't acting very lover-like, and earlier, he almost seemed to be throwing Dirk at her. Outside of bed, he was treating her more like Albrecht treated a trainee who had gotten some bad early lessoning and needed to have it beaten out of him. Except in the digging out, when he treated her as an absolute equal, neither cosseting her nor allowing her to take more than her share of the work. Provided her mind hadn't been tricking both of them, which was a very real possibility. Oh, hellfire, she sighed. At least she'd managed to clarify some of her feelings. And there wasn't anything she could do about it anyway, not until she had her gift under full control and could sort out what was real and what wasn't. She drank the last of the stone-cold tea and put up the harness, then slipped back into bed. Right now, the only thing to do was to enforce the sleep she knew she needed badly. It was best to just try and take things a day at a time, because at this point, she had more pressing problems to deal with. If she couldn't get her gift back under control, this would all be very moot. For she was quite well aware of how close she'd come to driving both Chris and herself over the edge. It could happen again, especially if he did something to badly frighten her. And if it did, it could end only too easily, in his death, hers, or both.
Chapter 10. Well, there was one way, Talia knew, to keep herself under control, and that was to work herself into a state of total exhaustion. So in the morning she rose early, almost before the sun, and she began pressing herself to her limits, making each day blur into the next in a haze of fatigue. It became impossible to tell what day it was, or even how long they'd been there. Talia usually woke first, at dawn, and would prod Chris into wakefulness. One or the other of them would prepare not only breakfast, but unleavened cakes with some form of soup or stew, something that could remain untended most of the day without scorching, simply because they both knew that, by the time they came in, they would have barely enough energy to eat and perform a sketchy sort of wash before collapsing into bed. After a hearty breakfast of fruit and porridge, she would wrap the companion's legs against the sharp edges of the ice crust while Chris haltered the churras, and all six occupants of the station would troop out into the cold to begin the day's work. Roland and Tantris would move up first and break the crust of ice and the hard snow beneath by rearing to their full heights and crashing down on it with their forelegs, or backing up to it and kicking as hard as they could. They would move back, and Talia and Chris would then take their places, picking up the chunks that had broken off and heaving them to either side of the trail they were cutting. The churras would use their powerful foreclaws on what remained, until they were halted by snow too packed for them to dig, or crust too slippery to get a grip on. Then the heralds would move the chunks they'd dislodged, scoop up the loose snow, and let the companions take over again. They would work without a break until the sun reached its zenith, then take begrudged time for a hasty lunch. On their return, they would work until darkness. Each day the trips to and from the station got longer. Sometimes it was only that which kept Talia working.
There were times, too many times, when their progress was limited to a few feet for a whole day of backbreaking labor, and she knew the station itself was furlongs from the road. It was when their measured progress amounted to little more than a dozen paces that the temptation to give up was the strongest. When darkness fell, Chris would tend the companions while Talia groomed the churras, checking them thoroughly for any sign of injury or muscle strain during the process of grooming them. Roland and Tantris, of course, could be relied upon to tell their chosen if they'd been hurt, but the churras were another story. And if one of the churras had to drop out of the work, their progress would be halved. Finally, Chris or Talia, usually Talia, would ensure that everyone was well supplied with food and water and blanketed against the night chill before they wolfed down their own dinners and sought their bed. It was the hardest physical labor either of them had ever performed. The constant cold seeped into their very bones, and their muscles never stopped aching. It wore them down, a little more each day. They had strictly rationed their own supplies, and the food they were taking in was not equaling the energy they were expending. They were getting thinner, both of them, and tougher, physically. It was a change Talia hardly noticed because it was so gradual, but once in a while she would think vaguely that her friends would have been surprised to the point of shock by the way she looked. Chris continued to hammer at her through the first week of digging out until centering and grounding had become reflexive. After that he left her in peace, only offering an occasional bit of weary advice. Talia's control over empathic projection came and went, at unpredictable intervals, although Chris evidently never noticed her projecting involuntarily. If he had, he would have pounced on her. Of that she was certain. Her shielding was returning now that she had something to form a firm base for it, but it was the thinnest of veils, hardly even enough to know that it was there. She worked at control with nearly the same single-minded obsession she was giving the physical labor of digging out. The only pauses in their routine were the two occasions when they again ran out of clean clothing. Those 2 days were given over to a repeat of their wash day, and to brave attempts to revive one another's faltering spirits. As tired as Talia was, it was easy to become depressed. Chris wasn't quite so much the pawn of his emotions, but there were times Talia found herself having to pull him out of despair. The endless cold did not help matters any, nor did the fact that they had indeed needed to cut green wood to use in their fire. The green wood, even when mixed with seasoned, gave off much less heat. Talia felt as if she'd never be warm again. But one afternoon, nearly a month from the time they'd first reached the station, she looked up from their task in sudden bewilderment to realize that they'd finally reached the road. And the road was as drift-covered as the path out had been. "Now what?" Talia asked dully. "Oh, gods!" Chris sat down on a chunk of snow with none of his usual grace. This was a scenario he'd never contemplated. He'd always assumed that once they broke out, the main road would be cleared as well. He stared at the icy wilderness in front of them and tried to think.
"The storm. It must have spread farther than I thought," he said at last. "The road crews should have been within sensing distance by now, otherwise."
He felt utterly bewildered and profoundly shaken, for once at a total loss for a course of action. He just gazed numbly at the unbroken expanse of snow covering the road, unable to even think clearly. Talia tried to clear her mind, to stay calm, but the uncanny silence echoed in her ears, and that feeling of someone watching was back. She glanced apprehensively at Chris, wondering if he was sensing the same thing she was, and in the next breath, certain it was all originating in her mind. The feeling of being watched was, if anything, more intense than it had been before, and ever so slightly ominous. It was very much akin to the uneasy queasiness she used to have whenever Keldar would stand over her at some chore, waiting and watching for her to make the tiniest mistake.
Something out there was unsure of her, mistrusted her, and was waiting for her to slip somehow. And when she did, panic rose in her and choked off the words she had intended. Chris stared at the unbroken ice crust as if entranced, unable to muster enough energy to say anything more. Gradually, though, he became aware of a feeling of uneasiness, exactly as if someone were watching him from under cover of the brush beneath the snow-laden trees. He tried to dismiss the feeling, but it continued to grow, until it was only by sheer force of will that he was able to keep from whipping around to see who was staring at the back of his neck. It wasn't entirely an unfriendly regard, but it was a wary one, as if whatever it was that was watching him wasn't quite sure of him. He tried to shield, to clear his mind of the strange sensations, only to have them intensify when he invoked shielding. And now he was seeing and hearing things as well, slight forms that could only be caught out by the corner of his eye and slipped into invisibility when he tried to look at them directly. And there seemed to be sibilant whisperings just on the edges of his hearing, all of which could well be from a single source. Talia had told him once already that she thought she was hallucinating. She could well be drawing him into an irrational little nightmare world of her making. "Talia!" he snapped angrily, more than a little frightened. "Lock it down!" And he whipped around to glare at her, enraged, and just about ready to strike out at her for her lack of control. Talia forgot the strange watcher, forgot everything except Chris's angry and untrue accusation. She flushed, then paled, then reacted.
"It's not me!"
she snapped. Then, when he continued to stare at her with utter disbelief, she lost the control she had been holding to with her psychic teeth and toenails. This time, at least, the companions were prepared and shielded themselves quickly. Chris, however, got the full brunt of her fear of the situation and her anger at him. He rose involuntarily to his feet and staggered back 5 or 6 paces, to trip and fall backward into the hard snow, his face as white as hers and unable to do more than raise his arms in front of his face in a futile gesture of warding. And the watcher stirred. Talia froze, the feeling that some power was uncoiling and contemplating striking her down was so powerful that she was unable even to breathe. Somehow she cut off the emotion storm, and simultaneous with her resumption of control, Roland paced forward slowly to stand beside her. He faced not her but the watching forest, his whole posture a silent challenge. There was a feeling of vague surprise, and the sensation of being watched vanished. Talia felt released from her paralysis and wanted to die of shame for what she'd nearly done to Chris. As he blinked in surprise, she turned blindly away from him, leaned against a tree trunk and wept, her face buried in her arms. Chris stumbled to his feet and put both arms around her. "Talia, little bird, please don't," he begged. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean... I lost my temper. It'll be all right. It's got to be all right. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." But dreary days of grinding labor and nights of too little rest had taken their toll of his spirit as well. It was only when the tears started to freeze on both their faces that they were able to stop sobbing in dejection and despair.
"It... that thing watching..."
She shook with more than cold.
"I don't want to talk about it," she said,
looking uneasily over her shoulder.
"Not here. Not now.
It wasn't you."
"No, I swear on my life."
He believed her.
"All right. Let's handle what we've got. The storm was worse than we thought," he said,
getting control of himself again.
"This is the very northernmost end of the road. They can't be more than a few days away, and we aren't running short of food yet. We'll be all right, especially if we start rationing ourselves."
"We won't need as much food if we rest,"
Talia said, drying her eyes on the gauze she'd used to protect them from sun glare.
"And we can plant a signal so that they know we're here. I can get the cross to hold me a good distance, and you're lighter than I am. About an hour's scramble will do. Wait here." He mounted Tantris, and the two of them headed back to the station, vanishing from sight down the narrow little valley they'd cut. Talia waited for their return, occasionally looking warily over her shoulder. Whatever had been watching her had been within a hair of striking her. Why she was certain of this she had no idea, but she could not rid herself of the thought. She had no idea of what had deterred it, but she did not want it to catch her unaware. She clung to Roland's neck and waited, exerting every bit of control she had. For it seemed to her that the Watcher had only acted when it appeared that she was attacking Chris. If that was the case, she had no intention of inadvertently invoking it again. It was at least a candle mark, and far too long for her peace of mind, before she saw Chris and Tantris trotting back. He carried 4 white arrows, 2 long branches, and some bright blue rags.
"These will show up at a distance. Here, pat on these, will you?"
He dismounted and handed her 2 of the arrows, and began working on his 2.
"We tie the arrows to the stick and plant the stick out in the middle of where the road is. When the crews find them, they'll know we're here and still alive. They'll even know for certain it's us if they happen to have a herald with them. Surely anyone with them will have been given our patterns."
"Why are we doing this?"
"If we don't, they might not clear the road this far. This is just the northernmost loop. It isn't strictly needed to get between Waymeet and Berry Bay. It takes longer to go around than to cut through Sorrows, but nobody travels much in the winter except heralds, and nobody knows where we've been lost."
He handed her one of his arrows in exchange for hers. Both of them tied the arrows to one of the branches and made them as conspicuous as possible with fluttering rags.
"You go toward Waymeet. I'll go toward Berry Bay," he said, preparing to climb up on the snow crust. "Plant yours at the first crossroads you come to. I'll do the same. Hopefully the road crews will find one of them before they give up."
"Chris, what if it snows again?"
"Talia, for the love of the goddess, don't even think that. Walk as far as you can, but be back here by dusk."
Talia had never felt so lonely. There was scarcely a sound from the white woods on either side. She could hear the creaking sounds of Chris carefully making his way across the snow crust behind her, sliding his feet so as not to break it. Even so, she heard the crunch that meant he'd fallen through at least once before he got too far away for the sounds to carry to her. It was a measure of his own dejection that he didn't even have the spirit to swear. She set out herself, often having to detour around high drifts that she didn't dare try and climb. Her eyes ached from tears and snow glare, and she was as tired as she'd ever been in her life. She was grateful that she was lighter than Chris. The snow crust was holding beneath her without any such mishaps as he had had. The silence was eerie, frightening. As frightening in its way as the howl of the storm had been, Talia was shivering long before she reached her turnaround point, and not just from cold. There were no sounds of birds or animals, no indication that anything else lived and moved here besides herself. That horrible feeling of something watching might be gone, but there was still something uncanny about the Forest of Sorrows, something touched with the chill of death and the ice of despair. Whatever power held sway here, it was unsleeping and brooding. She knew it beyond doubt, and somehow knew she was feeling only the barest touch of its power. And she didn't really want to trust to the supposed protection of her whites by venturing too far alone. She was more than relieved to find a half-buried crossroad sign. That meant she could plant her gaudy staff in the snow crust at the peak of a drift and retrace her steps. She was never so glad to see another human being as she was to see Chris picking his way across the snow, coming toward her. Back in the station, Talia surveyed what was left of their supplies.
"They'd better come soon," she said, trying to keep doubt out of her voice. "Even if we're careful, we don't have much. It'll probably last for a week, but not much more."
"If they're as worried as I think, as I hope, they'll be working around the clock, even by torchlight," Chris said, sheer exhaustion making his voice toneless. "It just can't be too much longer."
They may not recognize us as heralds at all, she replied, trying to joke a little. I doubt they've ever seen heralds looking so shabby. I've had to practically rub holes in my things to get them white again. Our appearance is hardly going to enhance the heraldic image. She screwed up her face in imitation of an old man's grimace and croaked,
Heralds? Yer be not heralds. Yer be impostors for certain sure. Gypsies, scalawags, and where got ye them whitewashed nags, eh? Heh?
Chris just stared at her for a long moment, then suddenly began to laugh as helplessly as he'd wept earlier. Perhaps it was their weariness that made them as prone to near-hysterical hilarity as to tears. Talia began to giggle herself, then crow with laughter. They collapsed into their bed nest together, legs too weak to stand up, and for a long time could hardly stop laughing long enough to breathe. No sooner would one of them get himself under control, and the other start to follow suit, when one look would set them both off again.
Enough, please, Chris gasped at last.
Then don't keep looking at me, Talia replied, resolutely staring at a stain on her boots until she got her breath back.
Berry Bay has a resupply station, Chris said, doing his best to maintain a serious subject. We can get new uniforms there, and we can get our leathers bleached and retreated. I'll warn you, though, the sizes will only be approximate.
Just so that the whites are white and not grey or full of holes.
I don't suppose you know enough sewing to alter what we've got, Chris asked wistfully.
She could tell by his expression that his fastidious nature was mildly disturbed by the notion that he would be looking considerably less than immaculate in outsize uniforms. Talia raised an eyebrow in his direction.
My dear Harold, I'll have you know that by my third year at the Collegium, I was making whites. I may very well have made some of your wardrobe.
Strange thought. He pulled off his boots, slowly. It wasn't you playing tricks on my mind?
No, she replied. Not until you shouted at me.
Gods. I think I must be going mad.
She was rubbing at her white, cold feet, trying to restore circulation.
Don't, please. It's the isolation, the worry, she responded, with a clutching of fear in her chest. Not enough rest, not enough food.
Are making me see things? Are you seeing things?
No, she admitted. But it seems like the forest is watching. Almost all the time.
Chris started. Talia saw him jump and bit her lip.
It's nothing, he said. Just, Tantris says you're right. He says the forest is watching us. Damn it. I thought it was you doing things to me. Sorry.
Chris, I lost it again.
Tears stung her eyes.
Hey, not as bad as last time. And you got control back by yourself, right?
Sort of. Whatever it was, when I turned on you, it suddenly felt like it was going to do something to me if I touched you. That was when I got scared back into sense.
And you got control back. However it happened, you got control back. Don't give up on me, little bird. And don't give up on yourself, either.
I'll try, she said, a faint tremor in her voice. I'll try.
Leaden silence hung between them until he took it upon himself to break it.
Jadis left you his harp, so I assume that you know how to play it, but I've never once heard you do so, would you?
I'm nowhere near as good as you are, she protested.
Humor me, he insisted.
All right, but you may be sorry.
She curled into the blankets to try and keep a little warmth in her legs and back and took the harp from him when he brought it from its corner. This was the first time she'd played in front of anyone but Jadis. The way the firelight caught the golden grain of the wood brought back those days with a poignant sadness. She rested her hands on the strings for a moment, then began playing the first thing that came to memory. The song was Sun and Shadow, and Chris was very much aware from the first few notes that she performed it quite differently than he did.
where he and Dirk emphasized the optimistic foreshadowing of the ultimate solution to the lovers' trials, and made the piece almost hopeful in spite of its somber quality. She wandered the lonely paths of the song's present, where their respective curses seemed to be dooming the pair to live forever just out of one another's reach. She was correct in insisting that she wasn't as technically adept a player as Chris, but she played as she sang, with feeling, feeling that she made you hear. In her hands, sun and shadow could tear your heart. The last notes hung in the air between them for long moments before he could clear his throat enough to say something.
"I keep telling you," he managed at last, "that you underestimate yourself."
"You're a remarkably uncritical audience," she replied. "Would you like her back, or shall I murder something else?"
"I'd like you to play more if you would."
She shrugged, but secretly was rather pleased that he hadn't reclaimed my lady. Her mood was melancholy, and it was possible to find solitude by losing herself in the music. Solitude that it wasn't possible to create when he was playing or she was singing. She continued, closing her eyes and letting her hands wander through whatever came to mind, sometimes singing, sometimes not. Chris listened quietly, without comment. The few times she looked up, his face was so shadowed that she couldn't read his expression. Eventually she ran out of music fitting her mood, and her hands fell silent from the harp strings.
"That's all I know," she said into the silence that followed.
"Then that," he replied, taking the harp from her, "is enough for one night. I think it is more than time enough for bed."
She had doubted she'd be able to sleep, but the moment she relaxed, she was lost to slumber. 3 days later, the station seemed to have shrunk around them and felt very confining, especially to Talia, who had always had a touch of claustrophobia. Her temper was shortened to near non-existence, and she feared losing it, greatly feared it.
"Chris," she said, when his pacing became too much for her to bear, "will you go out? Will you please go somewhere?"
He stopped in mid-step and turned to eye her with speculation. "Am I driving you out of patience?"
"It's more than that. It's..."
"That feeling of being watched. Is it back?"
She sagged with relief.
"You feel it too?"
"Not now. I did a little while back."
I send them both of us mad?"
She clenched her hands so hard that her nails left marks in her palms. He sat on the floor at her feet, took her hands in his, and made her relax them.
"I don't think so. If you'll remember, Tantris told me that the forest was watching us."
"What is it?"
"I only have a guess. It's Vanyl's curse. It's made the whole forest aware somehow."
"I don't think it likes me,"
she said, biting her lip. Chris had the listening look he wore when Tantris mindspoke him.
"Tantris says he thinks it's disturbed by you. You're a herald, but you're a danger to me, another herald. It isn't sure what to do with you."
"So as long as I stay in control, it will leave me alone."
"I would surmise."
He rose to his feet.
"And to keep you from losing control, I am going out."
Chris had decided to flounder his way down the road toward Waymeet, in hopes of meeting with a road crew. He entered the station to have an entirely unexpected and mouth-watering aroma hit him full in the face.
"I'm hallucinating,"
he said, half afraid that once again he really was.
"I'm smelling fresh meat cooking."
"Pretty substantial hallucinations, then, since you're going to have them for supper,"
Talia replied with a sober face. Then, unable to restrain herself, she jumped up from the hearth to throw her arms around him in a joyful hug.
"Two squirrels and a rabbit, Chris. I got them all, and there'll be more. The fodder is attracting them. I didn't even lose or break any arrows."
"Bright heavens," he said,
sitting down with a thump, hardly daring to believe it. There was no denying the stewed meat and broth Talia ladled out to him, however. They ate every scrap, the first fresh food they'd had in weeks, sucking the tiny bones dry, then celebrated with exuberant loving. They fell asleep with untroubled hearts for the first time in many days. They were awakened the next morning very early. The churras were stirring restlessly, and both companions seemed to be listening to something. Roland was overwhelmingly relieved and joyful, and Talia went deeper to find out why.
"Tantris says," Chris began, "there are people coming," Talia finished excitedly. "Chris, it's the road crew."
"There's a herald with them, too. Tantris thinks they'll reach us sometime afternoon."
"Have they reached our marker yet?"
"Yes. The herald had his companion broadcast a mind call to Oz when he found it. I might even have met them yesterday if I hadn't gone in the wrong direction, idiot that I am."
"How were you to know? How many are there?"
10, not counting the herald."
"Should we go out and try to dig the path out farther to meet them?"
"No," Chris said firmly. "The little we can do won't make much difference, and I'm still tired. We'll pack up, straighten things up here, and meet them where the path meets the road."
It seemed strange to see the station barren of their belongings, with only the empty containers that the supplies had been stored in to tell of their presence there this past month. It took longer than Talia had thought it would to repack everything. They did not leave the station until almost noon. When they reached the road, they could see the newcomers in the far distance. They waved and shouted, and could tell by the agitated movements of the other figures that they'd been spotted. The work crew redoubled their efforts, and before too long, though not soon enough for Talia and Chris, the paths met.
"Heralds, Talia and Chris!"
The white-clad figure that was first through the gap was unfamiliar to both of them, though his immaculate uniform made them uncomfortably conscious of the pitiful condition of their own.
"Yes, Herald," Chris answered for both of them.
"Praise the lady! When the guard learned that you hadn't stayed at Waymeet and hadn't arrived at Berry Bay, and that you'd left on the very eve of the storm, we all feared the worst. Had you been caught in it, I doubt you would have survived even one night. This was the worst blizzard in these parts in recorded history. Oh, I'm Tedric. How on earth did you manage?"
"We were warned by our churras in time to make the way station, but I doubt that we'd be in any shape to greet you now if it hadn't been stocked by someone other than the regular resupply crew,"
Chris replied.
"Whoever it was, he seems to have had an uncannily accurate idea of how much provender we'd need and what kinds."
"That's the way the witch is doing,"
said one of the work crew, a stolid-looking farmer.
"Kept at us this fall till we got it stocked to her liking. Even made us go back after first snow with some odd bits. Honey and oil, salted meat and fish. We had it to spare, praise Cairnus. And she's never yet been wrong when she gets one of these notions, so we went along with it. Happen, it was a good thing." "Praise Cairnus in very deed. I see you've got your gear. Come along with me and I'll have you warm and dry and fed before nightfall. I'm with the resupply station outside of Berry Bay. I've got plenty of room for both of you, if you don't mind sharing a bed."
"Not at all,"
Chris replied gravely, sensing Talia struggling with the effort of maintaining what little shielding she had against the pressure of 15 minds.
"We've been sleeping on straw next to the hearth for warmth. Right now a camp cot would sound like heaven, even if I had to share it with Tantris."
"Good. Excellent,"
Herald Tedric replied.
"I'll guide you both back. These good people know what they're doing, and they certainly don't need me in the way now that they've found you."
The members of the work crew made polite noises, but they obviously agreed with him.
"Fact is, Herald,"
the red-faced farmer whispered to Chris, "old Tedric's a good enough sort, but he don't belong out here. He's too old, and his heart's more'n a mite touchy. Way station supply post was supposed to be a pension and out position, if you catch my meaning. He ain't the kind to sit idle, even though he hasn't the health to ride circuit no more. We're supposed to be keeping an eye on him, make sure he don't overdo. Job's set up so's he could feel useful but wouldn't have to do anything straining. Guard's supposed to do all his fetching and carrying for him. But what with this storm and all, guard's busy clearing the road, seeing to the emergencies. When he found out you two was messing, nothing would do but that he go out with us. Gave us a real fright a time or two, getting short of breath and blue-like when we thought we might have found bodies. Good thing you turned up all right, or I reckon we'd have had a third body on our hands."
This put things in an altogether different light. Chris felt a sudden increase in respect for the talkative and seemingly feckless Harold. On closer examination, he saw that Tedric was a great deal older than he had first appeared, partially because he was bald as an egg, and partially because he had a kind of baby-soft face that tends not to wrinkle with age. His companion cosseted him tenderly, flatly refusing to race headlong down the road so that he could prepare the station for his guests. Talia and Chris took turns telling him what had transpired from the time they discovered the plague in Waymeet.
"So, you're the Queen's own, the one with the gift for emotions and mind-healing,"
he asked Talia, peering at her short-sightedly. She could sense his faint unease around her, even through the shields Roland was holding, and mentally shrank into herself.
"I wonder if you could do something for the Weather Witch."
"Considering that we obviously owe our lives, I'll certainly be glad to try," Talia replied, trying not to show her own unease and her real dismay at being asked to use her wayward gift. "Just who is she, and why do you call her the Weather Witch?"
"Ah, it's a sad story, that," he sighed. "A few years ago, it would be, when I'd only just been assigned this post, there was a young woman named Maven in Berry Bay who'd gone and had herself a festival child. That's a babe that no one will claim and whose mother hasn't the faintest notion who the father might be. People being what they are, there was a certain amount of tisking and finger-pointing until the poor girl heartily wished the babe had never been conceived, much less born. That's what made what happened to her all the worse, you see. You know, be careful what you ask for. You might get it. I'm sure she often wished the child gone, and when the accident happened, she blamed herself. She was taking her turn working at the mill, and she left the little one alone for longer than she should have. Poor mite was just beginning to crawl about, and it managed to wriggle free of the basket she'd left it in. It crawled straight to the mill race, fell in and drowned. She was the one to find the body, and she went quite mad."
"But why Weather Witch?" Chris asked.
"She must have had a gift, and her going off her head freed it altogether because she started being able to predict the weather. She'd be acting just as usual, dandling that rag doll she got in place of a babe. Then out of nowhere, she'd look straight through you and tell you that you'd better see that the beans got taken in because it was going to hail that night. Then, sure enough, it would. People in Berry Bay and for a bit around took to coming to her any time the weather looked uncertain. She began to be able to see the weather that was coming days, then weeks, then months in advance. That's why the villagers heeded her when she told them to stock the station. I wish they'd told me. I'd have laid in a good deal more on my own."
"You stocked it very well, and we've nothing to find fault with," Chris replied reassuringly. "I'm afraid, though, that you'll find we've used up just about everything that was there."
"That will be no problem,"
Tedric said cheerfully.
"I'll be glad to have a little task to turn my hand to. Most of my work's done in the summer, and winter's a bit of a slow time for me. But it looks to me as if you could use a full resupply yourselves."
"I'm afraid so," Talia said, as Tedric shook his head over the state of their uniforms. "I don't think the fabric is going to be good for much except rugs."
"I've got plenty of stock back at the station, and I'm no bad hand with a needle,"
Tedric replied.
"I think I can refit you well enough so that you won't be looking like crow scars. I've got all the necessaries for bleaching and refinishing your leathers, so we won't have to replace those. And your cloaks still look in fairly good shape, or will be after we clean them. If you don't mind staying a bit, I can turn you out looking almost like the day you left to take this sector."
"That sounds fantastic," Chris said with obvious thankfulness.
"I can help with the altering, sir," Talia added.
The old herald twinkled at her.
"But who tailors the tailor, then? And surely you wouldn't deny an old man the pleasure of helping fit a pretty young lady, would you?"
Talia blushed, and to cover it, settled my lady wrapped in her blankets in a new position on her lap. Without the harp case to protect her, Talia elected to carry her personally.
"What's this?"
Tedric asked, and brightened to learn it was a harp.
Which of you is the musician?
He asked eagerly.
We both are, sir,
Chris replied. But he really plays a great deal better than I do, Talia added. And Harold Tedrick, we'd truly appreciate it if you could find someone to make a new traveling case for her while we're here. We had to destroy the old one to make snow shovels.
The cabinet maker would be proud to oblige you,
Tedrick said with certainty.
In fact, he may even have something already made that will fit. Midwinter Fair's at the sector capital in a few weeks, and he's been readying a few instrument cases to take there, as well as his little carved boxes and similar trumperies. He's known for his work on small pieces as well as furniture, you see. I'll make a note to start stocking shovels in our stations from now on. Not every herald has harp cases to sacrifice.
They passed the village of Berry Bay just before sunset, Talia finding herself grateful for the shielding Roland was supplying her, and reached the resupply station with the coming of the dark. The place was much larger than Talia had expected. "Great heavens!" she exclaimed. "You could house half the collegium here."
"Oh, most of it isn't living quarters. It's mostly hay barn, warehouse, and granary. I do have 3 extra rooms in case some need should bring a number of heralds as far north, but only one of those rooms has a bed. Any more than 2 would have to make up beds on the floor. But let's take first things first. I expect you'd both appreciate a hot bath. It will pleasure both of you to know I have a real bathing room, just like the ones at the palace and collegium. While you're getting washed, I'll find some clean clothing for you to wear until we get your new outfits altered and your leathers cleaned. As soon as you're feeling ready, there'll be supper. How does that strike you?"
"It sounds wonderful. Especially the part about the hot bath," Talia replied fervently, as they dismounted in the station stable.
"Then take yourselves right in that door over there. I'll tend to your beasts and friends. Go up the staircase, then take a sharp right. The coppers all fired up. I've been doing it every day on the chance that we'd find you. The room you'll be using is sharp left."
They each took a small pack, and Talia took her harp and entered the door he'd indicated. Tedrick hadn't exaggerated. Though it only held a single bed, the bathing room was identical in every other way to the ones at the palace. "Which of us goes first?" Talia asked, thinking longingly of clean hair and a good long soak.
"You. You look ready to die,"
Chris replied.
"I'm feeling the strain a bit," she admitted.
"Then get your bath. I can wait."
When tight muscles were finally relaxed, and the grime that had accumulated despite her best efforts ruthlessly scrubbed away, she wrapped herself with towels and sought their room. She found that Tedrick had preceded them there. On the bed were laid out fabric breeches and shirts of something approximating their sizes. The approximation was far from exact. It was obvious that if these articles were representative of the kinds of clothing held in storage, there was a great deal of work that was going to have to be done. She stretched out on the bed for just a moment, only to fall completely asleep. Chris had taken himself downstairs again to talk in private with Tedrick. He hadn't missed the older man's initial unease around Talia, nor the fact that he had already known that Talia was Queen's Own and what her gift was. The identity of an internee was not supposed to be generally known, and the gift of the Queen's Own wasn't generally even a matter of public knowledge among the heralds themselves. He decided that he was a bit too tired for diplomacy and bluntly asked the older man where he'd gotten his information about Talia.
"Why, rumors, mostly,"
Tedrick supplied in astonishment,
"although I didn't credit the half of them. I can't imagine a herald misusing a gift, and I can't believe the collegium would allow anyone out who was poorly trained. And I've said so. But I must tell you, there are a lot of eyes and thoughts up here, and I regret to say some of them hoping to catch a herald in failure."
After a covering exchange of pleasantries, Chris climbed the stairs with a worried soul. He found Talia asleep on the bed and took his towels without waking her. He lay back in his hot bath to soak, his mind anything but relaxed. If anyone discovered the state Talia was in, not only would her reputation be finished, but the reputation of heralds as a whole and that of the collegium would be badly damaged. The faith heralds themselves had in the collegium would be shaken if they knew how poorly counseled she'd been. For that reason, they dared
not abort the circuit and head back. That would be the signal of failure certain critics of the system had been waiting for. Nor could Chris himself let any senior herald know the true state of things and how poorly controlled Talia was, for that would lead to a profound disturbance in the ranks of the heralds themselves, a disturbance that could only roll all the way back to Selene and Elspeth, with all the attendant problems it would cause them. It would be up to Chris, and to Talia herself, to get her back to the functional level she had before this whole mess blew up in their faces. It was with that sobering reflection he finished his bath and went to get dressed and wake her. She woke from her nap in a fairly good mood, giggling a little at the way she looked in the outsized garments Tedric had supplied.
"It's because 2/3 of the heralds are men, little bird," Chris replied, "and all the resupply stations get the same goods, so most of the clothing stored here will be made to fit men. I expect when he gets a chance to look, he'll find some things close to your size. If you think you look silly, look at me."
The waist of his breeches was a closer fit than hers, but the legs were huge and baggy and much too long, and the sleeves of his shirt fell down past his fingertips.
"I expect most of what he has is in two categories, lodge and tent. At any rate, it's better to have to cut down than try to piece on more fabric."
They descended the staircase to join their host, Chris barefoot and Talia in her sheepskin slippers, since their boots were so stiff from repeated soaking and drying that it was too much of an effort to try to pull them on. In any case, the dwelling was very well heated, and Chris's bare feet caused him no discomfort. They found the old herald puttering about in his room that seemed to combine the functions of kitchen and common room. He chuckled to see them, looking like two children clothed in their parents' cast-offs.
"I just took what was nearest to hand," he said apologetically. "I hope you don't mind." "They're clean and dry and warm," Chris smiled, "and right now that's all we care about. I must say that what I smell would have me pleased to come to table in a grain sack, if that's all there was to wear."
Tedric looked very flattered, and seemed to have no recollection of Chris's earlier interrogation.
"When one lives alone, one acquires hobbies. Mine is cooking. I hope you don't find it inferior to what you're used to."
Talia laughed. "Sir, what we're used to has been porridge, stew made with dried meat and old roots, half-burned bannocks, and more porridge. I have no doubt after the past month that your meal will taste as wonderful as your bathtub felt." Venison with herbs and mushrooms was a definite improvement over the meals they'd been making. A mental check assured them that Tedric had seen to Roland, Tantris, and the Churras in the same generous fashion. Both the companions were half asleep, with filled bellies, drowsing in heated stalls. When their own hunger was truly satisfied, Chris helped Tedric clear away the remains of the meal, while Talia ran back upstairs for my lady.
"You seemed so interested in which of us was the musician that I thought we'd repay you for your hospitality," Chris said, taking the harp and beginning to tune her. "One doesn't hear a great deal of music out here," Tedric replied, not troubling to keep the eagerness from his eyes. "I think it's the one thing that I really miss by being stationed here. When I rode circuit, I was always running into bards."
The old herald listened with a face full of quiet happiness as they played and sang. It was quite plain that he had missed the company of other heralds, and equally evident that he had told the simple truth about missing music out here on the border. Of course, it was very possible that the traveling bards had simply not noticed this station, half hidden off the road and placed at a bit of a distance from Berry Bay. It was just as possible that Tedric's work kept him so busy during the summer, the only time journeyman bards were likely to come this way, that he could not spare the time to seek the village when bards came through. Chris made a mental note to send a few words to that effect when they sent their next reports. Old Tedric should not have to do without song again if he could help it. When they finally confessed themselves played out, Tedric instantly rose and insisted that they seek their bed.
"I don't know what possessed me, keeping you up like this," he said. "After all, I'll have you here for as long as it takes to outfit you. Perhaps I'll hide all the needles for a week or two."
When they rose the next morning, somewhat reluctantly, as the feather bed they'd shared had been warm and soft and hard to leave, They discovered that he had already put their leathers and boots to soak in his vats of bleaching and softening solution. Talia helped him take some of their ruined garments apart to use as patterns, and they began altering the standard stock. Tedric was every bit as good with a needle as he'd claimed. By day's end, they were well on the way to having their wardrobes replenished, and it was not possible to tell that the garments had not been made at the Collegium. By week's end, they were totally re-outfitted. Once their outfitting was complete, they set about discharging their duties to the populace of Berry Bay. The rest and the tranquility had been profoundly helpful in enabling Talia to firm up what control she had gotten back over her gift. She had enough shielding now to hold against the worst of outside pressure on her own. That wasn't much, but it was better than nothing. And she felt her control over her projective ability would hold good unless she were frightened or startled or attacked. If any of those three eventualities took place, she wasn't entirely certain what she'd do, but worrying about it wouldn't accomplish anything. She almost lost her frail bulwarks when they entered the village. Chris had warned her that the rumors had reached this far north, but the knowledge had not prepared her. When they set up in the village hall, she caught no few of the inhabitants giving her sidelong, cautious glances. But what was worse was that the very first petitioners wore charms against dark magic into her presence. She tried to keep up a pleasant, calm front, but the villagers' suspicion and even fear battered at her thin shields and made her want to weep with vexation. Finally, it became too much to stand. "Cress, I've got to take a walk," she whispered. He took one look at the lines of pain around her eyes and nodded. He might not be an empath, but it didn't take that gift to read what the people were thinking when they wore evil-eye talismans around one particular herald. "Go, come back when you're ready, and not until." She and Roland went out past the outskirts of the village. Once away from people, she swore and wept and kicked snow hummocks until her feet were bruised and her mind exhausted. Then she returned and took up the thread of her duties. By the second day, the unease was less. By the third, the evil-eye talismans were gone. But she wondered what the reaction of the villagers was going to be when they sought out the Weather Witch on the morning of the fourth. The depression surrounding the Weather Witch's unkempt little cottage was so heavy as to be nearly palpable to Talia, and to move through it was like groping through a dark cloud. The Weather Witch sat in one cobwebbed, dark, cold corner, crooning to herself and rocking a bedraggled rag doll. She paid no heed at all to the three who stood before her. Tedric whispered that the villagers brought her food and cared for her cottage, that she was scarcely enough aware of her surroundings to know when a meal was placed before her. Chris shook his head in pity, feeling certain that there was little, if anything, that Talia could do for her. Talia was half-attracted, half-repelled by that shadowed mind. If this encounter had taken place a year ago, she would have had no doubt but that she could have accomplished something. But now? But having come and having sensed this for herself, she could not turn away. She half-knelt and half-crouched, just within touching distance, on the dirty wooden floor beside the woman. She let go of her frail barriers with a physical shudder of apprehension and let herself be drawn in. Chris was more than a little afraid for her. Knowing nothing, really, of how her gift worked, he feared it would be only too easy for her to be trapped by the madwoman's mind, and then what would he do? Talia remained in that half-kneeling stance for so long that Chris's own knees began to ache in sympathy. At length, her breathing began to resume a more normal pace, and her eyes slowly opened. When she raised her head, Chris extended his hand to her and helped her to her feet again.
"Well?"
Tedric asked, not very hopefully.
"The gypsy family who died of snow sickness 2 months ago. The ones in the Domesday book report. Wasn't there a child left, Levin?"
she asked, her eyes still a little glazed.
"A little boy, yes," Chris answered as Tedric nodded.
"Who has him?"
"I for Smithright. He wasn't particularly pleased, but somebody had to take the mite in,"
Tedric said. "Can you bring him here? Would the Smithright have any objection if you found another home for the child?"
"He wouldn't object, but here, Forgive me, but that sounds a bit mad.
It is a bit mad, Talia said, slumping with weariness so that Chris couldn't make out her expression in the shadows.